You're listening to Work and Life on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Here again is Professor Stu Friedman.
Welcome back to Work and Life on SiriusXM's Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I'm your host, Stu Friedman, and I am an organizational psychologist here at the Wharton School. I'm director of our Work-Life Integration Project, and if you're just joining us on this show, we explore the endlessly fascinating topic of work and the rest of your life. And our goal here on this show is to bring to you fascinating people and interesting insights from research, from practice, from all over the world to help you become better able to integrate the different parts of your life, your work, your home, your community, and perhaps most importantly, yourself, your mind, body, and spirit. We are live every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern. Tonight, we're here in Philadelphia, as we usually are, and love to hear from you. You can follow me on Twitter at Stu Friedman. That's Stewfriedman. And at Biz Radio 111. That's Biz Radio 111. You can also email us at businessradio@siriusxm.com. Just ahead, I'm going to be joined by Sam Polk and hear the story of how he had what must have taken a lot of courage to basically ditch his life as a successful Wall Street hedge fund trader to go on to found the nonprofit Grocery Ships and to create what I expect must be very meaningful work for himself and thereby be better able to bring his whole self to his work. But before we get to that, at the top of the hour, as we always do, I like to bring you something about work and life in the world. And what I want to bring to you this time is an article that was in the research literature called The iPhone Effect, The Quality of In-Person Social Interactions in the Presence of Mobile Devices. All right, what these researchers found was the following. They did a study of 100 pairs of people who were talking, and they were asked to talk about either a superficial topic or a more meaningful topic. And there was an observer in the room who was unobtrusive. In other words, the two people who were talking didn't know that this trained researcher observer was watching them, watching their interaction and describing it, coding it as to you know, what was happening. And what they looked for was whether or not one of the people in the conversation was holding a smartphone or had her smartphone on the table. That was it. And then afterwards, they asked a whole bunch of questions about the quality of the interaction and what it felt like and whether or not there was empathy flowing in both directions, whether or not people felt they understood each other. And so what these observers found was, over and above the effects of age, gender, ethnicity, and mood, the simple presence, the very presence of a smartphone, not whether it was on, but just its presence, had the effect of reducing the quality of the conversation and reducing the degree of empathy that people felt for each other in the conversation. My question to you is, how has your smartphone changed the nature of your interactions with your family, with your friends, with your coworkers? I'd like to hear your story. The number to call, 844-942-7866. That's 844-WHARTON, folks. If you didn't figure that one out, I'm telling you, 844-942-7866. Secondly, I'd like to know, what do you do when other people have their smartphones right there while you're talking with them? And even more so, why, you know, if they are actually interacting with it, what do you do when that happens to you? It's a ubiquitous phenomenon. It's something that many people experience. It's become a part of our daily lives and our interactions. And of course, it's a source of intrusion in the direct interpersonal contact that we have with other people. I know that when, if somebody, you know, if I'm talking to somebody and they have their smartphone out and they start looking at it, I immediately feel, oh, that other interaction that they're having through this digital device is more important than me. And, you know, I think I'm diminished in some way in their eyes. And I have to confess that I'm probably guilty of doing the same thing. And you know, the more you think about it, the more you realize that when you are indeed on your smartphone, you are saying to the people who are physically present around you that you are not attending to them. You're not giving them your attention. You're not giving them your psychological presence, which is what people feel the presence, you know, as either there or not there. So are you there? Are you not there? So again, the question is, how has your smartphone changed the nature of your interactions with people? That's something I'd like to hear from you about at 844-942-7866. Melanie, calling from Washington. Welcome to Work and Life. How has your smartphone changed things for you or not?
You know, personally, I feel like it keeps me more informed and in the conversation. So often if I'm in a meeting and there's something relevant that I want to check out or look up, I can do that and participate more actively in the conversation.
Because you're doing research on the topic that people are talking about?
Right. Someone might say, oh, I can't think of the name of that association, and I can just find it and right. offer it up right then and there instead of everyone sort of stumbling around the conversation.
All right. So, but that's an instance where what you're doing is kind of enriching the conversation by getting new information that makes it more kind of interesting and informed. Right, Melanie?
Right.
That's different than you're talking to your kids or you're talking to your friends while you're in a business meeting.
Exactly. Like, I think that feels a little just outside of common courtesy, you know, and it's certainly workplace kind of standards. I also feel that people, I think, maybe are oversensitive that people would actually do that. They're imagining that people are talking to their family and friends while in a work meeting, and I actually don't think people do that to a large degree.
Right. So that's it sounds like something that you wouldn't do, and you think that most other people don't make that kind of that error, that social error. They're actually, if they're on their smartphone, they're gathering information that's going to inform and enrich the conversation. You think that's how most people use it in business setting?
I think so. Mm-hmm. And even if they're not, I don't think that as long as they're participating, it doesn't bother me. If maybe they got a call or a text from the school, they can see that. As long as they're participating, it doesn't offend me. I feel like people are oversensitive to it.
Interesting. Well, Melanie, thank you so much for calling Work and Life. The number is 844-942-7866, and we're talking about how your smartphone has changed your interactions. Jim, calling from California, what's your story?
Well, I've got actually a couple of different takes on this. The first one is, of course, someone's sitting there while we're trying to hold a conversation, and they're holding another conversation via text or something, and they're not 100% engaged. Obviously, that's just kind of a turnoff. But on the other hand, I see myself and my wife and I using the smartphone as references. So if we particularly are talking about a restaurant, it was like we can't remember the name, so immediately one of us whips out our cell phone and starts using it as a reference. Or if we're watching a movie together on the couch and we can't remember which other movie that particular actor or actress was in.
I do that all the time. IMDb. So it enriches the conversation, you're saying?
That's correct. When used properly, and when we both are in agreement that this is what we're doing at this point in time to find that. But it's like I said, if somebody is actually holding another conversation via text with somebody else, it's kind of like trying to be on the phone and talking with somebody else at the same time, and it just doesn't work.
It doesn't work. You raised some really interesting points here, Jim, and that is that it has to be used wisely, and both parties need to understand what it is that you're doing. And so you actually talk about that. You say, honey, I'm going to check on IMDb here to see what other movies Kevin Bacon was in, so that because we neither of us can figure that out from our own memories. And you agree with your wife that you're going to, you know, look at your cell phone now, not to be rude, but rather to find out an answer to a question that she has, something like that.
It's like, Who was he in it? What movie was he in again? Hey, let me find out. Hold on. I'll tell you right now.
Right.
We're racing to find out who can find out that answer first, actually.
Well, you know what I find, though, that sometimes there's something that I want to find out about that other people in the conversation really don't care about, but I've gotten interested in it. So I say, hey, I'm going to look that up now. And everybody else is thinking, you're leaving us now. Nobody cares about that thing that you think about, Stu. So why are you leaving? Jim, thank you so much for calling Work and Life. We're talking here about how smartphones have changed your interactions, our interactions. This is a topic we're going to come back to. But I'd like to now switch gears and move to our next guest, who I'm very, very happy to welcome to our show. It's Sam Polk, who is the founder and executive director of Grocery Ships. Sam is a former Wall Street hedge fund trader who found, if I have it right, and Sam's going to correct us, correct me, who found that his work was devoid of meaning and indeed worse, that he was addicted to a certain aspect of it, and he changed. He transformed his life and his work and eventually founded Grocery Ships, which is a non-for-profit company where he helps to educate people about food and indeed feeds the hungry with food scholarships. Sam, welcome to Work and Life, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Stu. It's good to be here.
So I learned about you from, as probably most people in the world learned about you, from the opinion piece that you wrote in the New York Times in January, For the Love of Money. Can you give us just a brief synopsis of what it is that you wrote there for our listeners?
Yeah. So I talked about how I went to Wall Street when I was 22. I had a summer internship at CSFB, and, you know, I remember walking onto the trading floor and just being blown away. I mean, you know, Wall Street was sort of everything that I could have ever wanted out of a life. And so I was I worked at CSFB, and then I got a full-time job at Bank of America.
Hey, let me just jump in here, Sam.
Yeah.
Everything that you wanted in life was right there on the trading floor? Really?
Yeah. I mean, you know, certainly for that sort of 22-year-old kid. You know, my dad was this guy who sort of believed, you know, we sort of grew up sort of lower middle class, and he was always sort of reading the paper and talking about, you know, billionaires and people that were really successful, and he wasn't successful, but he wanted to be successful so bad. And so I grew up sort of with that huge desire in my heart, and or in my head rather.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember walking onto that trading floor, and like we had, you know, we moved up to a sort of a nice area of town for high school. So I'd been around like some wealth in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember walking out onto that trading floor and just seeing people who, just by looking at them and the kind of clothes they wore and the, you know, pants they wore and the kind of haircuts and what their sort of skin looked like, you could just tell they played golf a lot. And it was just like a different level of wealth than I'd ever seen. And so for me, yeah, I was like a kid about to graduate from Columbia, terrified about sort of finding my place in the world, and really, you know, terrified about where I was going to end up, and, you know, was I going to be important, and was I going to matter? And to me, those guys on Wall Street looked like they mattered.
Because they had all the external trappings or the indications of what wealth?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a funny thing. It's like, I think you're sort of like pointing, or at least, you know, asking questions around this really interesting issue, which is, you know, one of the results, and we can get back to the Times piece, but one of the results of that New York Times piece I wrote is that I got hundreds of letters from college kids. And, you know, most of them were in some way or another sort of asking me if I could help them get onto Wall Street. but I really understood where they were coming from, because they were taught, you know, they sort of like, they knew, they didn't come out and directly ask it sometimes, because I had written a story that was sort of, you know, about leaving Wall Street for this and that reason.
And that inspired kids to write to you and say, how do I get a job on Wall Street?
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at, is that, like, yeah, they did that, but then they also opened up about sort of what it felt like to be a college kid. And I mean, you know, we think that these kids that go to school where you teach, you know, Wharton or Columbia or Harvard, that they sort of like have it all made, right? And in some sense, they really do. But they're also sort of stepping out into adulthood, into a culture that has told them from birth that really the only way to sort of be valuable in the world is to be rich, powerful, or famous. Mm-hmm. And there are none of those at that time. Mm-hmm. And so I remember for me, you know, I was terrified when I was about to graduate. I was terrified, you know, Columbia was this sort of badge of honor and prestige. And I was like, you know, God, you know, where am I going to go? Am I going to just sort of disappear into the world? And then here comes Credit Suisse First Boston or Goldman Sachs, and they say, here, you have an equally prestigious brand name, and you know you're on this path that, you know, our culture sort of celebrates and then vilifies, you know.
Well, not so much vilifies, though, when you were getting into it, right? When did you graduate from Columbia?
Yeah, it was 2002 was my first internship.
Okay,
right,
so
after the internet bubble burst.
But in 2002, though, it was still, there wasn't that much vilification, or was there?
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think that we've always, you know, as a, you know, Western culture or a, you know, post-BC culture, we've always had this thing about moneylenders and, you know, people, you know, Scrooge, and there is this sort of, like, backdrop of, like, hey, don't, money's not going to make you happy. But that maybe, in my mind, takes up, like, 3% of the sort of cultural dialogue, and the 97% is all about, oh my God, get money as fast as you can and as much as possible. And by the way, Wall Street is the place to do that.
Right. So I'm speaking here with Sam Polk, who is the founder and executive director of Grocery Ships. And we're talking about his transition from a successful Wall Street hedge fund trader to a very different life. And I was inspired to talk with Sam because he's, I think, an example of someone who is, what we were talking about in the last hour, changing one's career and thereby changing one's life by better aligning, you know, what you do with what you care about. And that's such a core concept when we talk about integrating the different parts of life for mutual gain. So, Sam, fill out the picture of what you wrote about in the Times piece and the implications that it had, the impact that it had.
So pretty much I, you know, continued up the Wall Street ladder years and years of working really hard and becoming a trader and then a hedge fund trader. And I started to make real money and sort of live that life that I'd sort of dreamed of. So, you know, I would fly into the airport and there'd be a black car waiting for me and I could go to any restaurant I wanted. I went to so many World Series games on brokers, you know, credit cards.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, like, it was just like, you know, I could go
all those Yankee games?
Yankee games, Knicks games, you know, I could be second row at the Knicks sort of whenever I wanted. You know, it was like there was, and for, you know, remember, I was a, you know, a 25, 26-year-old kid, and so that was a tremendous feeling of power in the world.
And you did all that without breaking the law?
Yeah, I think we 99% didn't break the law.
All right.
There were some things like, I remember once we flew out to Vegas on a broker's dime, and I remember noticing that our seats, we went to see the De La Hoya Mayweather fight, and I remember our seats were better than Sacha Baron Cohen's seats. And I remember seeing him and being like, oh, wow. And then I asked somebody how much these tickets were, and they were like, oh, these are $5,000 a pop.
Mm.
And I was like, that may not be legal.
No. Right. All right. So that's a relatively minor transgression, probably.
Probably. But yeah, it was all totally above board.
So you're living the life, the dream.
I'm living the life. And the thing that I started to notice was like, look, you know, there is no doubt that sort of making money, getting a $1 million bonus feels good. And you go home that night and you know, show your girlfriend, I am proud of this. Look at this, you know. But then I also noticed at the same time that the higher I went, it wasn't like the sort of jealousy and envy that sort of had motivated me in my life. And I mean that, like, those college kids that write to me, they're looking at these sort of people they read in the paper, Lloyd Blankfein and JP and Jamie Dimon, and they're saying, you know, God, I want to be that. And that's how I felt, too. You know, I'd see really rich people, or I'd read an article about a trader or a billionaire in the paper, and I'd be like, I just be swarmed with envy. As an aside, it makes me wonder, like, how many readers of, like, Us Magazine and Forbes and Bloomberg just read those and just feel envy the whole time they're reading it, you know?
Mm.
And I would feel like that. And even as I continue to make millions, I still notice that I felt like that. And I started to say, like, you know, there's something wrong there. And then, you know, sort of going back to what you were talking about, like, you know, trading was like, to me as like a 22-year-old, it looked like the coolest thing in the world. And it was so much fun, you know, like making big bets and seeing, you know, news headlines that all of a sudden made you $1 million. And it was really exciting. But over time, I started to sort of like separate from actually what I was doing and be like, you know, sort of just be like, this stuff that I'm doing every day doesn't matter. And there's nothing sort of valuable about it, even though I'm getting very well compensated for it.
Did you say something valuable or value less?
Yeah, yeah. There's not something valuable.
Not. So yeah. Was there a moment where something clicked, or did it just kind of build up over time that you realized there's something wrong here?
You know, there were so many moments. I mean, one I talked about in the Times piece was this moment where my billionaire boss was saying, I was in a meeting, and this was in 2009, so it was like in the worst part of the crash, and we were talking about the new hedge fund regulations being made by Congress. And by the way, our hedge fund was up money during that time, so everybody else was losing money, and we were making money. And I remember I was in a meeting, and we were talking about the new hedge fund regulations, and everybody thought they were a bad idea, but I was sort of in the midst of this crisis where I was sort of seeing the sort of greed that was in me, but also this system that I was a part of, this sort of financial system that had in some sense caused some of this collapse, and then to my mind sort of wasn't taking accountability for it. And I kind of puffed at my chest and said, you know, well, isn't this better for the system as a whole? And my boss just shot me this sort of withering glare and said, I don't have the brain capacity to think about the system as a whole. I can only think about what's good for us and our company.
That's what your boss said.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't so much, I mean, maybe I judged him, but more than anything, like, I judged myself, you know, and I was like, God, you know, there's got to be more to this than, you know, my dream my whole life had been to be a billionaire. And I saw this guy, and, you know, I'm not saying all billionaires are like this guy or whatever, anything like that, but, mm-hmm. like, you know, I would have, the fact that he was a billionaire, to me, in my mind, billionaire was like hero, you know, or has it made. And the fact that he was still sort of self-seeking, for lack of a better word, made me just realize in that moment, and this is really what I wanted to convey in that Times piece, was that, you know, there is no end point. There's no, at least for most of us, or at least for me, there's no moment where you say, oh, I've got enough, I'm done, let me go do, you know, what I was meant to do. And a lot of these kids that wrote me, these college kids, would say that. You know, one kid wrote me in particular, I remember, he was like, Sam, I just want enough money to travel and take care of my parents, take care of my wife, and I want to go to Wall Street, and the number I have in my mind is $6 million.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, first of all, I was like, I have way less than $6 million, FYI, and B, 99% of the world has less than $6 million, and really, like, maybe that's true, that you would be the one guy who, if you got to $6 million, if you spent your 20 years, then you would stop. But for most of us, and at least most of my friends on Wall Street, what it looked like from my eyes is that they got that $6 million, and then they wanted 12, and then they wanted 18, and so they had nicer houses and nicer cars.
The habit had been built. It didn't stop.
Yeah, they still had that hole sort of inside, and that's, you know, that we were all sort of trying to fill with money, power, prestige.
Hang on one second. I want to just remind people that this is Work and Life. I'm Stu Friedman, your host, and I'm speaking now with the founder and executive director of Grocery Ships, which we're going to be talking about shortly. That's Sam Polk, and he's talking about his transformation from a successful Wall Street hedge fund trader to the director, founder and director of this non-for-profit. So talk a little bit more about that void that you were just referring to.
Yeah, I mean, my sort of belief, okay, and this is just me personally, but is that, you know, I was trying to fill this, I would call this hole inside me, I would call it like a, and this is not how I thought consciously about it, but it's how I've come to think about it, is this sort of sense of worthlessness. And the only way that I sort of thought I was valuable was Columbia, making $1 million on Wall Street, having a big loft apartment on Bond Street in downtown New York.
Mm-hmm.
And those things that, you know, that you get when you're on Wall Street. And after a while, I just sort of realized that hole was still there no matter how much money I was trying to fill it with.
Mm.
And I said, you know, like, I started to really do some work and say, like, you know, we have this really brief life, and not to get all philosophical, but we have this...
No, let's get all philosophical, Sam.
And we have this really brief life, and the sort of, if you play out the Wall Street story all the way, what you end up at with is like a guy who maybe has $100 million, and the world thinks he's successful, and he's, you know, in the papers, and he's got all this stuff, but in the end, he's just spent his entire life trying to aggregate both money and, you know, accolades for himself. And I think that's, I really do believe, that's why I feel like a lot of compassion for these college kids is because I believe that's what our culture tells us to do. Like, I believe, like, we all hear about Jesus and we all hear about Mother Teresa, but really the culture says you are important if you go and start your tech company and make and turn it into $1 billion. And so you go out and try to do that, and in the end, even if you're successful, I believe you sort of haven't done anything. And that was sort of the thing for me, which was like, you know, I still talk to this spiritual teacher who has been, you know, who I'm more grateful for than anybody I could ever imagine. And she used to say things to me like, oh yeah, those billionaires, they don't mean anything. Or she would say it like as if they weren't successful. And to me, that was heresy.
Mm-hmm,
and I'd be like, no, they're a billionaire. You don't understand. These are important, powerful people. But to her, they weren't.
Wait, so you sought out the advice and counsel of a spiritual guide at some point along your path here to awareness, to greater awareness of what was wrong?
Yeah, I mean, it was actually right in the beginning, and that's the thing, you know, you ask if this is like a moment that happened, but really, you know, 3 weeks into that first internship at Credit Suisse First Boston, I was dating this girl that was so far out of my league, like you wouldn't believe it. I still meet people and they're like, oh my God, you dated Joanna August? And I'd be like, yeah. I mean, I was punching outside of my weight class, but I was in love with this girl and we'd been together for 2 years. And 3 weeks into my internship, she dumped me. And I was so, I mean, you know, I kind of
laughed. Wait, so you had been dating her before you began this internship?
I was dating her at Columbia.
Oh, okay.
And I was dating her, and she dumped me. And it was like, it was one of those sort of like first love, didn't see it coming, devastating heartbreaks. And, you know, I've been through some pain in my life, but I tell you, breakup pain is right up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so devastated that I could barely sort of do anything. I could barely eat. I could barely get out of bed in the morning.
And so you were depressed, it sounds like.
I was immediately depressed. But I had this internship that was the most important thing in the world to me, aside from this girlfriend. And so I ended up,
so yeah. which was more important?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm glad that the internship was so important because it allowed me to sort of, I guess, humble myself enough to call this woman.
Uh-huh.
Who I'd met a couple years before when that same girlfriend had took us to couples counseling.
Ah.
And she was this Native American spiritual teacher.
Hmm.
And when I'd gone the first time, I thought, okay, first of all, she's not a PhD in psychology. She's not a psychiatrist. There's no Ivy League degree on her wall. No, thank you. But then 2 years later, she was the only sort of counselor I knew.
Hmm.
And so I called her, and I started working with her every week. And by the way, every week from then until now, and I still talk to her. In fact, now, right now, I talk to her twice a week.
Huh.
And what she sort of was talking to me into my ear. She was almost whispering, you know, a completely different perspective on the world, which was, you know, Wall Street was all about a hierarchy, right? And I believe that our culture is about a hierarchy that says, you know, the more money you make and the more famous you are and the bigger the tech company is that you started, the more valuable and important you are. And so that's what we're all on this, or at least I was, on this sort of chase to get up to the top of that. And that's what these college kids who are writing me are in the beginning stages of their attempt to meet the hierarchy. And she would say the opposite. She would say, no, there is no hierarchy. Everybody is equally valuable. What you think of as like the way the world works is actually just how your sort of culture sees it, but Native American culture saw it totally differently. And they saw it that everybody was equally valuable and that the focus, the sort of value as a of a life was in the sort of inner character that you cultivated as opposed to your outside achievements. And how you treated the love and empathy and compassion you treated people with as opposed to what's on your business card. And, you know, frankly, I thought she was a wacko, you know. And I was like, you know, I was 22, and I was like, okay, yeah, but just tell me how I can get over this breakup so I can get on to
my billion-dollar quest.
Yeah. But, you know, by the time I left, so that I was on Wall Street for 8 years, and I'd say, you know, the first year I sort of believed her about 10% and Wall Street 90%. And then halfway through I believed her about 40% and Wall Street 60%. But then towards the end I started to actually think, hey, you know what, maybe she's right, you know? And that's when I started to, like, you know, sort of understand. It was almost like a moment like in The Matrix where, you know, he takes the red pill and he comes to see the truth of the world that he's in. You know, and in some sense, that's what happened to me. I would just hear these conversations that I had heard 100 times before about, you know, on Wall Street, you refer to people, you know, literally by the size of their bank account. So somebody would say, hey, that guy over there, he's a $25 million guy. Hmm. Or they'd say, that guy over there, he's a $100 millionaire. And it wouldn't be, it just occurred to me that this wasn't about, you know, how much money they had, so what they could do with that money. It was just how much money they had as a signifier of their value as a human being.
And that became too much for you and ultimately led to a shift about which we're going to hear more when we come back. I'm Stu Friedman, director of Wharton's Work-Life Integration Project. And my guest this hour, telling a remarkable story of transformation, is Sam Polk, who is the former Wall Street hedge fund trader and founder and executive director of Grocery Ships. And when we come back, we're going to hear more about what Grocery Ships, how that founded, how you came to found that, and what it's all about and what you do in the world with that organization. You're listening to Work and Life on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Stay with us. Oh, yeah. We are back. It's Work and Life on Sirius XM's Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I'm Stu Friedman. I'm director of Wharton's Work-Life Integration Project, and my guest this hour is Sam Polk. He left a wildly lucrative career as a Wall Street hedge fund trader, sitting in front of Sacha Baron Cohen at Las Vegas fights, to find something more meaningful in his life. He is the founder and executive director of Grocery Ships. Sam, welcome back, and tell us, how'd you get to Grocery Ships?
Well, so I left Wall Street when I was 30, which was, you know, till then, you know, well, probably the hardest thing that I'd ever done. And it was like, you know, I literally just resigned, and my boss, you know, I sort of manufactured a reason to argue with my boss. But in the end, as I was leaving, he was like, I'm sorry you're leaving. I think you could have made a lot of money here. Hmm. And, you know, that was like a harpoon in my heart, you know, because I really was like walking away right at the height of my sort of earning capacity.
I thought you had already been making a lot of money.
So this is how I'll tell you what I made, and this is just bonuses, I think, if I remember correctly. But my first year, I think I had 7 years of bonuses or something like that. So it was like $40,000, $75,000, $125,000, $500,000, $1 million, $1.5 million, and then $3.75 million. And imagine that on a graph.
Our engineer is weeping now as you're speaking. I'm sorry to tell you, yeah. But continue.
I know. And imagine that. But just so you know, about that $3.75 million, I had to give back half of it because that was part of the deal with the hedge fund, is that if you left at any time during that year, you had to give back half your last year's bonus.
Ouch. So you had to give up almost $2 million to walk away?
That's right. And, you know, ahead of me was like, by the way, my boss, so there was billionaires, and then there was the head of trading, and then there was me. I was a senior trader. And as I was leaving, the head of trading resigned. So I was at least in contention to be head of trading. And I don't say that for my own ego, but just to say that, like,
that was
sometimes chuckle about, like, there was a lot of multi-million dollar bonuses in the future sort of stretching out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was really hard, you know, both for me in general, because I'd been so focused on making money my whole life, but also because it really was like walking away from, you know, the beliefs of a culture, you know, and like, you know, there was a lot of people that I talked to during that time who didn't agree with that decision, and a lot still don't.
I have to ask you, Sam, is your father still around?
My dad's still around,
and so
he would not have agreed with that decision, although him and I don't talk very often these days.
I see.
I didn't seek his counsel.
I see. Yeah, because from what you were saying earlier, it seemed like this would be hard for him to grasp.
It would be hard for him to grasp, that's right. But in a lot of ways, you know, that's sort of what this was about, you know. I mean, we, you know, we talk about, like, where that sense of worthlessness comes from. And for me, you know, a lot of it came from my dad. You know, my dad was this guy who was, you know, focused on money and focused on himself and his sort of extracurricular activities and not so much focused on me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was, you know, and he also had this, like, temper, you know. And so my sort of experience growing up with my father was this experience of not being his focus and also becoming more and more desperate to impress him. And that's the thing that, like, you know, I hope to convey a little bit in my article and also this book that I've written, which is that, like, you know, my bosses and Wall Street were my dad in so many ways, you know. I went from being a teenager trying to impress my dad from wrestling, you know, winning wrestling tournaments,
mm-hmm.
to a 25-year-old trying to impress my boss,
mm-hmm.
by making a, you know, $10 million Alltel trade.
Mm-hmm. But you broke through and you became more of who you want to be, and you founded Grocery Ships. So I know our listeners are eager to hear what that is about. So tell us what it is, and then, you know, where specifically the idea came from and how you founded it. What is Grocery Ships?
Really a health program for low-income families struggling with obesity. So obesity is clearly this problem across economic spectrums, but it's worse in low-income communities. And so what we do is we go into a community, and by the way, the name Grocery Ships means scholarships for groceries. So we take applications from families. We select 10, so it's as if 10 families receive a scholarship to learn about nutrition. But what that looks like is not just nutrition education. It's a 6-month program that includes nutrition education, healthy cooking classes, shopping skills. It includes financial assistance. So there's like an incentive program where if families, you know, do certain activities like, you know, eat five fruits and vegetables in a day or demonstrate weight loss or do exercise, and they earn money, which they can then spend on healthy groceries. And also there's a, you know, that's sort of the left brain part of it, and the right brain part of it is a sort of emotional support group. So really what it is, you know, these 10 families sitting around in a circle every week for 2 hours. And, you know, some of it is sort of like left brain, let me explain to you how to read a label, but mm-hmm. a lot of it is sitting around talking about all the other things that lead to obesity and, you know, issues with health, including stress, mental health, you know, childhood trauma, you know, emotional emotional eating, food addiction, stuff like that. And so really we've created this sort of like safe space where, you know, this group of families gets supported by grocery chips, but mostly by each other to facilitate sort of personal transformation.
And how did you come upon the idea to create this organization?
God, you know, it's like that Steve Jobs speech where he talks about how his whole life kind of led up to this, but he didn't sort of know it. So, you know, my family struggles with obesity. Both my parents were overweight. Two members of my family have had bariatric surgery.
What's that for those people who don't know?
That's when you get your stomach stapled because you're super overweight.
Gotcha.
And so, you know, that has been, and I struggled with weight heavily growing up, and then I got into wrestling and sort of went the other way and developed what would probably these days be called an eating disorder. And, you know, and so food has been something that has always been on my mind and that I've sort of struggled with and sort of made a lot of strides on. But then, you know, the real sort of philosophical reason behind grocery ships was sort of what I was talking about, which is that, like, I walked away from Wall Street and this sort of hierarchy worldview where you're always trying to get to the top, and I sort of recognized one day that the consequence of everybody trying to get to the top is that we're stepping over people, and the people that we're generally stepping over is people in poor communities who have waste dumped in their backyards, and their kids go to decrepit schools, and freeways are built through their neighborhoods, and all the myriad ways that we sort of let poor people know that they're not as valuable as those of us on Wall Street. And I don't mean to get sort of sanctimonious, but I definitely said, okay, I've been, it was like, you know, go back to that Native American spiritual teacher. It was like my whole life I'd been focused on climbing the rungs, and then I sort of saw that she was right and she had a point, and that if everybody is equal, we live in a world that doesn't treat people like that. And so while I do believe that obesity is an issue in Beverly Hills and the Upper East Side and all these great, you know, wealthy places, it's mostly an issue in lower income communities, and there's not a lot of people sort of trying to help those families. And so I just wanted to create a program that was really about, you know, I would say the two fundamental principles of our program are equality and reciprocity. And so what I mean by that is, like, you know, our focus is on helping people that sort of need help, but treating them not like, you know, do-gooders coming in to tell them how to live, but treating them as equals with total respect and admiration for, you know, what they're doing. And the reciprocity part of it is really about, like, you know, my focus is about sort of, you know, doing something that speaks to my heart and is about sort of connection and empathy as opposed to self-seeking. But also the whole structure of the organization is about reciprocity. And so what I mean is we're a nonprofit, but we're also a social business. And so we're just starting now to, you know, we've developed this extensive curriculum over time that has to do with both nutrition education, but also an emotional curriculum. And now we're going into corporations. And so people hire us for corporate wellness. And we come in and we bring nutritionists and we create community and safe spaces within corporations and talk about nutrition and health. But that money then goes to, first of all, costs, and then it goes to pay for the low-income families in the surrounding areas.
I am Stu Friedman. I'm your host here on Work and Life, and I'm speaking this hour with the founder and executive director of Grocery Ships, Sam Polk, and he's telling us about how Grocery Ships works and how it's growing. So you're bringing programming to companies, and what do they get out of it?
Well, they get, so there's a huge corporate wellness movement, right? Like, for example, this one you know, there's one company that I'm talking to that's a guy who runs like a tech startup in LA that has like it has to do with Twitter, and it's sort of a big deal.
That's where you're based, right, Sam, in LA?
Yeah, we're in LA, and he says, hey, you know, Google is known for having these corporate wellness programs. We want to have a corporate wellness program. And I say to him, well, look, you're in luck. Not only will we bring a corporate wellness program, but in addition to that, your money won't just be going to some, you know, company trying to make money for itself, but it'll be going to low-income communities in the surrounding areas, and you'll actually be helping families that may not have the, you know, great programming job on Silicon Beach that you do.
Hmm. And that tends to go over well in your pitch to corporate wellness purchasers?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you know, I think it, I mean, look, we're young, so we'll see, but, you know, my belief is that it will go over well for two reasons. One, because I believe that people are generally good, and so if you're faced with, you know, two choices in corporate wellness, and one is funneling money back to lower-income communities, great, fabulous. But two is that I think it definitely has a big PR handle.
Yep.
And one of the things that we've been sort of fortunate in is, and some of it had to do with my article, but it's getting a lot of press, and so, you know, we'll be announcing, oh, this company is a grocery, uses grocery ships for corporate wellness, and they can hold that up to their shareholders as not only a benefit to their employees, but also what they're doing in civic engagement.
Ah, so it serves that purpose as well.
Yeah.
You know, being a good corporate citizen and contributing to the world, as many, many, not only companies, but certainly I see this in my work, both in companies and also with my students here at Wharton. Yes, believe it or not, Sam, at Wharton, we have a lot of students, more than you can imagine, whose heart's desire is to do good through their work.
I believe it. Like, that's the thing is, like, you know, a lot of people took my article as being like Wall Street is evil, and it's really not that. Like, what I thought more than anything was that something was missing in my life,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that's true for a lot of people on Wall Street. But I also think that, you know, I don't actually break the world down into, like, good people and bad people. But if I had to, it would be all people are good people. Some just have had a harder time than others.
And so by making this change and leaving so much on the table, as they say, financially, and making this radical shift that had been brewing over time. It wasn't like one day you woke up and said, that's it. You'd been developing this new consciousness of your identity and how you wanted to live your life over a long period of it sounds like introspection, dialogue, and struggle.
That's right.
You changed. And how has your life changed since in terms of, like, your working life? How do you feel about yourself now in this new role in society?
Well, I'll tell you what, like, I think, like, the word is just, like, integrity for me. And I don't mean integrity in the way of, like, my moral character, but in the way of, like, everything is sort of together and centered for me. So, you know, I work as hard as I did on Wall Street. And, you know, there's also, you know, great, you know, money-making opportunities, not quite the same level of Wall Street, but people will come ask me to speak, and I, you know, make several thousand dollars to go speak and stuff like that. But it's all with this, like, with one thing in mind, which is, like, I am sort of, like, living a life that is in line with my principles.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not a perfect life. I got problems all the time. I'm stressed out, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But there's never that sort of dissonance inside me.
Mm-hmm.
Where it was on Wall Street. And the dissonance on Wall Street was sort of like, okay, I'm going to do this for as long as I can to get the most out of it and then do what I sort of want to do with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I left Wall Street, I got dozens of phone calls from my people that I knew on Wall Street. And, you know, interestingly enough, most of them, like, congratulated me. And they
Wow.
may have been just being nice, but most of them said something along the lines of, you know, congratulations for doing something that I wish I could do, but I can't do it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that a lot of people feel that. And again, going back to that article, that's really one of the, what I wanted to, like, sort of let people know, which is, like, you know, you're graduating from Wharton this year and you go to Goldman Sachs. Well, there's a very good chance you're going to make a lot of money. And there's a very good chance that you're going to like that money and you're going to like the house you get and you're going to like the vacation homes and you're going to like the business card and everything like that. And yet it still won't do it. At least it didn't do it for me.
Mm.
And so that, you know, I just wanted to be one voice saying, like, look, this is just not the answer, or one of many voices saying that.
So how do you advise people like that who say, and who might ask you, hey, you know, I'd like to explore, you know, a different kind of life too, because I don't have that sense of integrity, which, by the way, Sam, it's the exact way that I use that term in my books and in my teaching, the sense of oneness or coherence or wholeness that comes from aligning what you do with what you care about. But what do you say to people who ask for your advice? And I'm sure people do.
Well, two things. First of all, say I completely respect where you are and where you're coming from and how hard this decision is, because, you know, I'm constantly, you know, having to admit that literally the hardest thing I ever did in my life is sort of walking away from this lifestyle. And compared with the real hardships that a lot of people face, that's not that much. But for me, it was, like, really intense. So I say that I respect you. And then the second thing I say is, you know, you can see this path, right? So let's say you're graduating Wharton. You can see this Goldman Sachs path, and you know that in 8 years you'll be making probably upwards of somewhere between $400,000 and $2 to $3 million, and maybe there's, you know, 20 years from now you could be making $10-20 million, and of course you may end up being David Tepper and starting your own hedge fund and making $1 billion a year. So that path you can see, and that's on the right side. But on the left side is a path that you can't see. But so what I tell them is, like, what I believe is that inside every one of us is the unique compilation of experiences and beliefs and, you know, purpose that has inside you the ability to make one gift to the world, one sort of path that nobody has ever taken before. But in order to get there, you can't go right. You have to go left. And, you know, you could do what I did, and it's like, and make a turn 8 years into the, you know, mm-hmm. right side path. But that's what I tell people, is I say, you know, on 8 years on Wall Street, I learned a lot about companies. You know, I think about, there was this one trade that I did where it was like this Unisys trade where, and not to bore you, but it was a trade.
And we only have about a minute or so left, Sam, so.
Okay, I'll make it fast. It involved derivatives, loans, and bonds, and understanding of the bankruptcy process. And there was so much to know about it. And it occurred to me later that I made $5 million on that trade. And it occurred to me later that, wow, all that experience that I'd built up to enable me to do that trade, there was something else out there that I could have done with that fire that comes with being in your 20s. And who knows what that is?
So that's the question that you leave your friends and colleagues with when you're talking with them about how they might.
Like, you know, do you want to take, you can take your Goldman Sachs path and it leads a certain way, mm-hmm. or you can take a different path.
Take a different path. That is, I think, a most apt note for us to close on. Sam, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation and for sharing your experiences, your insights with such candor. It's really been a pleasure having you here on the show. Please tell us more about how people can find out about Grocery Ships and what you're doing next.
Yeah, go to groceryships.org and check out all about us. And also, if you're interested in some corporate wellness stuff, just give me a call.
All right, then. Sam Polk, thank you so much for joining us on Work and Life.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You can also follow Sam at Sam Polk, S-A-M-P-O-L-K, on Twitter, and at Grocery Ships. That's G-R-O, well, Grocery Ships. What a profound story. And, you know, this show tonight has really raised some, I think, important questions and provided some important insights about our relationships with our work and who we are as people and how important it is to be mindful of being able to provide help to others. That's where we started the show, and this is where we ended. What is it that is your gift to bring to the world? And being able to discover that through a lot of trial and error is what Hermie Ybarra talked about in terms of changing careers and making changes in your actions to discover what it is that's most important to you. You need to ask help. For help of other people in order to do that well, but it does take a long time. It doesn't happen overnight. Sam Polk's discovery that the path he was on was the wrong path, it was 8 years into his career as a successful hedge fund trader on Wall Street before he was able to muster the courage, the will to make a major transformation in his life and to start on a new path, but it didn't happen overnight. He had a lot of help. He asked for help, and he made that a part of his daily, weekly practices to explore, well, what really matters to me? What do I need help with in becoming the person that I am here to become? So that is an important set of lessons and ideas for all of us to treat ourselves and the world around us with respect and be willing to ask for help on the things that are really troubling to us and that we struggle with. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us on tonight's show. I want to thank our producer, Lisa Montaneo, our engineer, Dan Baker, and I hope that you'll tune in next week for another edition of Work and Life when I'm joined by Gretchen Spreitzer, who is a professor of management at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, go blue, my alma mater, and by Kathy Lingle, who is formerly the director of the Alliance for Work-Life Progress, who has a great historical perspective on this whole field. For more information about our show and about our roster of upcoming guests, visit worklife.wharton.upenn.edu, or just Wharton Work Life. You can subscribe to our forum there, where we have every week we post articles about our radio shows, and you can read all about them there. You can write to us at businessradio@siriusxm.com. And until next time, I'm Stu Friedman. You've been listening to Work and Life on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School on Sirius XM 111.